on a schedule. We'll call the Commerce Committee to order. Today's Monday, March 16th. It's 6:30 after noon.
We are waiting for
An agenda here, but I think we can start with Senator Jensen, Senate File 1698, dealing with weights and measures. You may proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1698 is the Weights and Measures Agency Bill.
Thank you.
It has some provisions in it. Section 1 provides language to clarify that the Weights and Measures Division has the auditing authority and can review relevant documents in the auditing process. Section 2 amends existing statute regarding misdemeanor violations. Currently, the law states that a seller who gives a lower number or a buyer takes a greater number of pounds or cubic feet per barrel is guilty of a misdemeanor. This just takes barrel from that list. Section 3 talks about the availability of to utilize existing advertising in regards to whether it is a diesel or a biodiesel fuel blend. And then the remaining sections of the bill basically cover moving to the ASTM standards that are current as of 2014. And I do have someone here to testify on the bill as well.
All right, Mr. Brickwitty, did you wish to comment on this a department bill?
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. This is the department's weights and measures bill. Thank you to Senator Jensen for authoring it. And she has touched on all of the sections of the bill. I'm happy to answer questions from members. I will note that Section 3 of the bill, dealing with advertising on boulevard and canopy signage, reflects agreement that the Commerce Department, working with the Agriculture Department, Biodiesel Task Force, and the Petroleum Marketers Association this summer to correct an inadvertent potential issue that would have caused station owners to have to, at great expense, frequently reface their signs. And so this is a good compromise that addresses that issue. And happy to take questions from members.
Any questions of the Government Affairs Director of Commerce? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple explanations on Section 1, Number 7. I guess it would be lines 1.24 and 1.25. Can you explain again what that does?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, thank you. That is a clarification to the department's existing auditing powers. There is this language that we're proposing to insert into 239.011 appears later in Chapter 239 in a section dealing specifically with petroleum products. So this would give the Weights and Measures Division the same auditing ability to look at paper records for all of the work that is done. If you can believe it, where we see this issue popping up most frequently in our work is through our inspections of packages in grocery stores, primarily with fish. Fish are frequently glazed when they're shipped from Alaska or someplace overnighted to Minnesota, and that percentage of the glaze is built into the price. If you can believe it, our Weights and Measures staff has a procedure for actually dissecting the fish to determine how much glaze is on it if there's a dispute. We would like to look at the paper trail and make sure that that's clear rather than actually getting into the physical product going forward.
Thank you. Sandy. Oh, excuse me. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Jensen or Mr. Brickwitty, either way. On page 3, lines 324 to 327, just kind of cleans up, as I understand, the term diesel fuel, and that would be able to use year-round then. Is that correct, without changes, with the change of the percentages?
Mr. Chairman, right. Senator Dames, yes, that's correct. The intention has always been for station owners to not have to reface their signs during the course of the year. So this language makes it clear that on the boulevard or on the canopy of a gas station that the term diesel fuel can be used to advertise any product that's approved by the federal government for use in a diesel engine.
The follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Senator Dames. And this is just kind of a cleanup, in a sense, from last year's bill. A little confusion on that. So this just cleans up what the intent of last year's bill was, correct? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, yes.
Okay. Further questions? Ms. Aaron, did you wish to?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify briefly. My name is Sandy Nairn. I'm with Messerly & Kramer. I'm here representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I refer to a letter that's in your packet that was sent by my client on this. Very briefly, they have concerns about Section 3 of this bill. Under current law, the stations would be required to advertise, not only in their canopies, but in magazines or whatever, that they are selling a biodiesel blend. This section of the bill waives that requirement for them and lets them just say it's diesel fuel. It's our opinion that consumers need to know what they are buying, if for no other reason than use of increased levels of biodiesel blend does require increased maintenance costs. I think even the advocates of the mandate that passed last year do acknowledge that increased maintenance is needed in order to use this kind of fuel. So we respectfully oppose Section 3 of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say two things. First, there is still the requirement that the blend and the product and the amounts be on the pump, so the consumer will know and they should check their pump, no matter what the awning says or the sign says. So I understand the need for consumer awareness on what kind of fuel they're putting into their vehicle. And it's my understanding that this has actually been running since July 1st, 2014, since the mandate, and then through October without any reported problems.
Okay. All right. Any further testimony from anybody for or against this legislation? Okay, Senator Jensen, you can make the motion, too. I believe it goes to the floor. Is that correct?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate File 1698. Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. What we're going to try to do, if possible, is to get through, probably try to get through all of this today so we don't have to come back tonight. That's my wish. And matter of fact, a few other members of the committee have even grabbed me in the hallway and Senator Jensen, do you wish to talk about Senate File 1265?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1265 is what we're calling Right to Advice Act. What it has to do with is in the event that an agent, an insurance producer, works with someone and sells them a health policy, you would be considered the agent of record. There has been some confusion, and there's one section that I'll get to later in the bill that addresses MNsure and the availability to ensure that the agent that is helping the person apply actually gets recorded as the agent of record. But there are situations that happen outside the exchange, too, and that's what this bill deals with. In Section 1, we're basically putting into legislation a definition for agent of record so that people clearly understand what we're talking about. And it's when an insurance producer is listed by the consumer as the person that they wish to have help them and advise them and work with them on their particular policy. And then we define and talk about an agent of record, what that means, to document the agreement going forward. It's signed by the agent of record and the policy holder or an applicant, and that's important to remember that we do this up front and make sure that an applicant that's looking for health is able to decide who it is that they want to work with them to make sure that they're understanding what they're getting. I'll talk briefly about then Section 5. The consumer retroactive appointment of a navigator or producer permitted. Right now, what's been happening as an agent or a producer, you have no real way to know if what you put into the website or online gets forwarded to the particular company that you're appointed with to write through. So this would only apply if you're appointed with the company, and that's all the way through the bill. If you're appointed with that company, you have the ability through this legislation to turn in and make sure that you are recorded as the agent of record and be compensated for the work that you did for that person. But it's on behalf of the consumer that we want to do that. So if they're there and want you to be the person as an agent and a producer to represent them, you have a way, we have a way through this agent of record process to ensure that that happens for the consumer. And I'd be happy to take questions. I'm not sure if anyone has listed. Sure.
Senator Pratt before the witness. Go ahead, Senator Pratt.
Please.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen, and Senator Jensen for allowing me to make a few comments. My name is Chris Schneeman. I run an independent agency here in St. Paul. I also serve as a legislative chairman for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, and I'm also on the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which collectively represents over 54,000 licensed agents throughout the state of Minnesota. I'll keep it really brief, but I'm here to lend support and strong endorsement for this bill. We believe that in this time of change, Minnesotans need the most support they can possibly get, both in the evaluation of what policy is appropriate for them and the ongoing service that they need throughout the year. So that's the extent of my testimony, and I really appreciate this consumer-centric bill. Thank you.
Do you get paid for any of those committees you're on? You named about 5-6 committees you serve on. That's pretty good service to the industry. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, when we were doing the MNsure bill, it was very clear that a navigator wasn't an advisor. They were just there to help someone work their way through the system.
Special guest.
I think what we found is that buying insurance is not like buying a shirt on the Internet, that it's much more complicated. And so my question is, why do you have retroactivity for navigators? We already, I thought, had a process for them versus these agents of records who are actually advising.
Doesn't hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the field that you use to designate yourself, whether you're a navigator or an insurance producer, is the same field and is not. They also need a way to make sure that they get credit and the payment that they for the work that they did with that particular person.
Thank you.
Senator Kazoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm on the bill as well. I think the issue that we're trying to get at, members, is that if you saw the Office Legislative Auditor's report, we saw that there was a drop of 66% of the agents and brokers involved selling this got out of it. And so I think this is one of the ways that we address that and take care of that. So I support the bill. But I have talked to some of the providers, and they do, I don't know if they've expressed concerns to you or not, Senator Jensen, but assuming this goes forward, I want to make sure if there's anything that we're, you know, is not clear or that we need to make crystal clear, that we, you know, continue to have an open mind if there's things that we're not taking care of in this bill, but I do support it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gazelka, I have had a couple conversations in regards to the agent of record as far as the timing goes outside of the exchange more than inside, and have made a commitment that I will make sure that that's cleared up so that agents are not taking other people's business away from each other. This is meant to be the first person that signs them up has that agent of record.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think this hopefully clears things up quite a bit. Yeah, and
it'll help.
We kind of did that, I thought, last when we passed the MNsure bill, but I guess this makes it clear. Lots of things we did. All right. Anybody wish to speak in opposition to this bill? Senator Jensen moves that Senate File 1265 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Is that correct? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Laurie or Desick and could we try to
when they're done.
It's going to be quicker.
Peter could start talking about the.
There we go. Oh, Senator Desick is here. Senator Desick, welcome to the committee. We have before us Senate File 1679, Auto Insurance Transportation Network Financial Responsibility. I see you have the commissioner at your side, and you may proceed, Senator, with your bill at 1679.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 1679 outlines insurance responsibilities for transportation network companies that provide ride sharing for a fee. You can use your phone to call for a ride. I actually have my phone here. The app shows you how far away the driver is and gives you an idea of how long it will take for them to get there, and the fee is charged to your credit card, so you don't have to have cash. Many people like the idea of the no-cash option and the ease of using the app. They view it as a safe, clean way to get from point A to point B. The concern arises because TNC drivers use their personal vehicles for commercial activity but do not have commercial auto insurance. Minneapolis and St. Paul have local ordinances that regulate these companies, but Commerce Department has some concerns if the ordinance requirements are adequate. Commissioner Rothman will testify about his concerns. As technology changes, we often play catch-up, and there are discussions throughout the country on what levels of insurance should be required. The bill does not prohibit companies from doing business in Minnesota. We are simply laying out insurance requirements. There are three phases for a TNC driver, and the bill discusses these phases. The first phase is when the driver turns the app on, saying that they are available to pick up a ride. The next phase is when they have engaged the app, so someone has requested a ride and they have accepted that, and then they go pick the passenger up. And then the third phase is when the passenger is in the car. After the driver drops the passenger off, they can either turn the app off and be done, or they can continue to be available to accept additional rides. The bill as drafted requires $1.5 million in coverage for all three phases, so across the board. We started there because we increased the coverage last year on limos to 1.5. I don't know if this is where the bill should end up, and I don't know if this is the best, if that's the correct number, but that's where we started. And so I'm going to kind of leave that up for some discussion and some of your guidance. The $1.5 million, that is not what other states and other communities are at, including Minneapolis and St. Paul. Most are lower, and some are lower when the app is on, for the phase when the app is on, but they have not engaged a customer or have not picked up a passenger. So that is some of the discussion I think we should have. What level of insurance is needed to protect consumers is the bottom question we should be asking. I have two additional testifiers that can share with you what's happening around the country and answer specific questions on the bills. And then I believe there are also some TNC representatives here to share their concerns about some of the language in the bill. First, members, I have an author's amendment, and it literally is changing paragraph and inserting subdivision, adding a this before a section, and then again removing paragraph and inserting subdivision. It is a very, very
clarified language. Senator Dahl moves that the amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Desick.
With that, members, I will turn it over to Commissioner Rothman.
Before that, Senator Fishback.
Mr. Chair and Senator Desick, I'm just wondering, is someone going to actually go through the bill?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, when is that going to happen?
We have Mr. Commissioner Rothman, and then I'll have the two other testifiers come up, and they'll help me go through the bill.
It appears as though there's a lot more in the bill than just $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Rothman, welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the opportunity to discuss this important and developing issue today. I also would like to thank Senator Desick as well as the bipartisan group of senators who are co-authors of the bill and bringing forth Senate File 1679. As you know, the Commerce Department is the state's insurance regulator, and as Commissioner, I fully support Senate File 1679. This bill addresses big insurance gaps and protects drivers and families from loss resulting from an accident. Now, TNCs are an innovative new business development. They provide consumers with new transportation options, business and job opportunities for many Minnesotans. We encourage this new business development at the department. We're not discouraging that in any way. As the business grows, however, the department has highlighted significant questions regarding gaps in insurance coverage that place drivers, passengers, and members of the general public at potential risk. This was brought to my attention last spring. I heard a story of a young girl who was killed on New Year's Eve 2013. A TNC driver struck a young family in San Francisco, killing a six-year-old girl named Sophia Liu. Her mother and brother were also hurt and injured in the accident. Their story is ongoing as the child's family is now engaged in a legal dispute with a company over damages because there is not clarity regarding liability and insurance coverage that was in coverage at place at the time of the accident. In other words, the existence of an insurance gap has placed a tremendous burden on the family. Simply put, this should not happen in our state. Minnesota families shouldn't face this burden. California took action, and as well many other states. In May of last year, my staff and I at the department issued a consumer alert offering tips for both TNC drivers and passengers and their riders to point out and make sure that they understood the gaps in the insurance, both as riders and drivers in these cases. The Commerce Department's interest is simply that drivers, passengers, and the general public are properly covered in the event of an accident. Adequate insurance coverage must be in place so that, in the event of an accident, it is clear who bears the risk. So in December, I sent a letter to the Commerce Committee leadership. I think a letter has been distributed for the members, calling out this question and suggesting that the state take action to address these issues. I highlighted that the development of TNCs across the country has raised important issues for states to address and that we should tackle them here in our state. What we cannot have in Minnesota is a situation similar to what we saw in California. Senate File 1679 clarifies the insurance requirements for companies operating in Minnesota throughout the entire TNC experience. As Senator Zizek indicated, it covers phases 1, 2, and 3 of those responsibilities. It provides drivers, passengers, and the public confidence that no matter the situation, they will be covered. In doing so, the bill appropriately balances putting responsible insurance coverage requirements in place and allowing for continued innovation and that business opportunity for these companies. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Yeah, questions of the commissioner at this time. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, what differentiates a TNC from a taxi company?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, you know, taxis have been traditionally understood and defined. They're companies, they have employees, they have the actual cars and all of that. TNCs, it's a different business model structure. The companies are primarily Uber and Lyft. They have as well these applications, technology applications, where they push a request for a ride on a mobile device in people's cars. The drivers themselves are not considered to be employees of the company. They're separate drivers, and then they go out and participate in the driver process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, my understanding is, and they, you can ask them, there'll be representatives here after this, but they are a technology company. It is, they provide the technology and the app that connects drivers who are using their personal cars to others who are looking for a ride. And so it is, they're providing the connection. And so they have viewed themselves as more of a technology company than as a transportation company. And that's, you know, for the most part, all of it is they just use the app or cabs have a, a dispatch system.
Mayor Fishback.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, are you actually going to, I understand that you explained it, you gave us a couple, 3 or 4 lines about the bill, but can someone go through it? Kind of give us, I mean, section by section. I know there's definitions and I've been trying to, you know, read it, but I'm
Believe
just,
me.
There's yeah. a lot in here.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I'd ask Mr. Bob Johnson and Mr. Passmore to come up and go through the bill. and then also explain kind of what they're doing across the country.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just three quick comments, and then, Senator, I'll walk through the bill section by section. And as Senator Dietzick has said, there's a reason that half of our nation's commerce commissioners have issued consumer alerts, similar to what Commissioner Rothman just described, and that's because there is a coverage gap. The coverage gap puts Minnesotans, consumers, either driving in the business of this transportation network company or riding as a passenger. So, and thus, that has precipitated a debate around the country that's accelerating and going on in states everywhere. And so that's the reason why we need this legislation, is to make certain that we don't have a coverage gap for consumers who are engaged in this. And this is not a fight, frankly, over the innovation and the new method of transportation and what this represents for consumers. That's not what we're here for. We're working with Senator Dietzick to deal with this issue. And it really springs out of the following. I'll just make a statement to describe. And this committee works with these issues all the time. Personal auto, personal homeowners, and the commercial coverages. This committee gets legislation on liability coverage and other issues like that. But this technology and what's happening today, it's the commercial use of a personal asset. If I had to give a one-line description of what's the issue that's before the Commerce Committee, and Commerce Committees are coast to coast, commercial use of personal assets are not covered by personal policies. So that's the follow-up to that, by the terms of the policies themselves. So everyone here, or virtually everybody here, if you went home and pulled your personal auto policy and flipped through it, you'd be able to find in it what's called a livery, L-I-V-E-R-Y, exclusion. And that's, the livery exclusion is for the commercial use of your personal auto. If you have an auto and you're going to use it commercially, then you'd buy a commercial auto policy. That's what taxi cabs do. They have commercial auto policies that cover them 24/7, and whenever they're using that car, there's commercial coverage there. So that's the reason for the legislation, why we need to have to deal with the gap and make sure that we're clear on the rules with this technology and the interplay, if you will, between the two lines. And it's those clarity of the rules, Senator Fischbach, that I will jump into the bill then, because then this is what supplies the clarity. The subdivision one of the bill does provide these four definitions of what a TNC is, the driver. So the network, transportation network financial responsibility, that's actually the reference to the policy coverages that this bill requires, so we'll come to that. And then the participating driver's motor vehicle insurance, that's a reference to the driver's personal auto policy. So those are the four boxes that the bill deals with. Definitionally, then, in subdivision two, there's a disclosure that's required of the TNC that they're obligated under this language to disclose to a driver any limits of insurance that they provide. So we want to have transparency and clarity between the TNC and the individual involved in that business. It is a commercial business. And subdivision three is really the operational language that specifies the requirements and the amounts of coverage that this legislation would impose and make a state law in Minnesota. And you can see that and these are coverages that, again, this committee has works with bills all the time that deals with these coverages. And then the way the bill is structured is that it describes, as Senator Dietzick described, these phases of the business. So the phase being when the application's turned on, there's no one in the car, and you're looking for business. So that's one aspect. When you connect with someone who wants to ride, then that's a phase of the business. And then the third one is when the person is actually in the car and you're transporting them. So what the bill does, and there's a little, we've talked to Senator Dietzick about this, there's some repetitive nature because we duplicate some of the coverage language because the phases are repeated in the bill. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it's done that way because really what we did is copy in large part how the California legislature enacted this bill last year. And the California law that was passed was supported officially by all of the parties out there. all of the parties supported the California legislation that was passed. So Subdivision 3, again, specifies then, and it goes through the coverage amounts in terms of the $1.5 million in liability coverage. That's under Subdivision 3B1. The PIP, personal injury protection, that's the requirement in paragraph 2. And as you all know, Minnesota law requires every personal auto policy to have personal injury protection. Paragraph 3 then mandates, and again, the $1.5 million of the uninsured, underinsured coverage. And again, in Minnesota, we're different than other states. That's why this bill isn't verbatim California's law, because we have a no-fault system. California does not. So we have to have language in this bill that deals with that. But Minnesota mandates uninsured, underinsured in all of the personal auto policies all of us in this room have. That's not the case in other states around the country. So we put that in at 1.5. Paragraph 4 is the collision and comprehensive coverage. But today in Minnesota, we all have the choice. We don't need to supply that coverage. It's not required. So what the bill does, it doesn't mandate it, but what it says is that it mandates it if the individual made the choice on their own to supply that coverage on their vehicle. If they don't make that choice, then this does not mandate it. It tracks with the individual consumer's decision, which we all have today, and whether or not. Now, if you have a car loan on a vehicle, you're likely to have to supply that coverage, but if you don't have that, it's an optional coverage, if you will. So those are the coverages that we require. It's duplicated in two places, but it's the same requirement. And it's duplicated because this bill divides those phases, those three, but they're all the business operations of a transportation network company. They're all the commercial business operations. So that's repeated in D, then 1, 2, 3. It's the same coverage requirements. So that's the parts of the bill and the definitions that deal, Mr. Chairman, with the network. Transportation network financial responsibility. Then Subdivision 4 now loops back to, and again, when I started, I said there's a need for clarity of the rules, because we really don't want to put people in a situation, and you'll see in a minute why that's important, to have clarity of the rules between the coverages, when they kick in, who's responsible, and kind of the transparency of that relationship. Subdivision 4 deals with the individual who's driving their personal auto policy. And the language that we put in there expressly says that there's a statutory exclusion under that policy from the moment you click the app on till the moment you finish. That's the business operation, if you will, that any consumer would be engaged in if they're engaged in this. And that's really that. Then there's a paragraph that requires that there's no duty to defend under that personal auto. So I would describe these as clarity in the rules. And again, as I described earlier, auto policies today have a livery exclusion that for years has excluded the commercial use of your personal automobile policy. We do keep in the language, expressly in that subdivision 4, the opportunity for the marketplace to change and evolve. And it is, as we speak, that there are companies, insurers, that are coming out with coverages to frankly, kind of help meet these needs of consumers. So we want to make sure we leave open that opportunity for the market to develop. It is changing. I suspect it's going to continue to change and develop. And Subdivision 5 is a statutory requirement of cooperation in terms of the party when disputes arise. And Subdivision 6 is a requirement of proof of insurance. And we end with, frankly, a kind of a catch-all consumer protection at the very last section of the bill that provides in Section 2 of the bill that under the automobile insurance plan that, I'm sorry, under the Auto Assign Claims Bureau, which is a longstanding statute in Minnesota that provides an ultimate safeguard for consumers to make sure that their claims get paid. If some insurer doesn't pay in an instance, this makes certain that the auto assigned claims will pay if for some reason what we just talked about with the mandates doesn't kick in and is operational. So that, Mr. Chairman, is a walkthrough on the specifics of the bill and the reasons why that we support it. I believe it's very important that we make clear that this commercial activity and the risk of it not be put in the personal auto driving pool. It shouldn't be put in the personal auto driving pool, and Senator Dietzick's bill does provide the clarity of the rules, covers the gap, and deals with the consumer protections that are being debated coast to coast today in this country. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarifying question. So I'm driving around going to the hardware store, or I'm sitting at, I drop my daughter off at gymnastics or something like that, but I'm signed into the app because I know I've got some free time. Are you telling me that all of my travel during that time is now business travel versus personal travel when I've got nobody in the car and I haven't accepted to take a passenger?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, the business of this TNC is when you get in the car and turn the app on, because now you're eligible to pick up a ride. So, yes, you're in your business activity. If you're not inclined to be doing that, then you probably wouldn't have the app on. But the app on is the advertisement by an individual driver that I'm looking for business and ready and willing to go. So, yes, I would tell you that when that app is turned on, this will require that this coverage be in place, because if while that's app is on and something unfortunate happens and whenever something unfortunate happens and somebody is hurt, then we want to make sure there's not a coverage gap. Mm-hmm. And there could
Senator be. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, can you give me a sense of how much insurance a taxi cab driver needs to have in Minneapolis?
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, I've been told that the cab drivers in Minneapolis have a commercial policy that is 100, 300, 100, I believe. Yes. So they have a commercial policy, and that is 24/7. And so they, if you are an owner-operator and you have your own car and you're a cab driver, you have a commercial policy, 100, 300, 100, under the Minneapolis ordinance.
And so to the testifier, Senator Dietzick, so now for this style of service, there's a requirement under your bill for them to be at, for there to be a policy at $1.5 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion.
Dietzick.
So in the cabs, I'll go back to the cabs. If you're an individual owner, you have that. But a lot of the cabs work for a cab driver, and there's cab people here. If you have questions, they can come up and address them maybe a little better. But I've been told the cab companies might have a higher policy that's up to 1.5 as opposed to the individual driver. And so then the individual TNC driver wouldn't have that $1.5 million, but the TNC company would. If that makes sense.
Mr. Chair, just a couple more questions. I noticed that in your bill, you have in subdivision 2, the disclosure to participating drivers. Is there any notice to the patron? Let's say, for an example, if I get in that cab, how am I notified as a consumer of this change in insurance policy cost or rate or coverage, I should say?
Senator Mr. Johnson, did you have a
Mr. Chairman,
shot at that?
Senator, mm-hmm. We're not trying to, in the bill at least as it's drafted, there's not any attempt to bring a disclosure to the individual that's coming in for to get a ride. So we want to make certain of the clarity that the drivers know, and then the bill will impose the mandate so that we know. The transportation network company has to meet that mandate. I guess I haven't. I'm not aware. Mr. Passmore is here from a national perspective and can maybe answer the question that any of the other states that have passed this, and now the list is growing, if they've addressed your specific question. I don't know that.
And maybe the testifier can speak to that question, but the reason why I'm asking the question is because you framed this as a way to protect the consumer. You said that you want to make sure that a consumer is protected, and if a And if a consumer is to be protected, then surely that you want to tell me how much I'm insured for if we believe it's so important for the insurance number to be $1.5 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, the Minneapolis Ordinance, and so some of the ordinance may address that, the Minneapolis Ordinance does require the existence of the insurance required to be posted on the TNC Network's website.
And so
that's
to Senator
Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but here there's no such requirement. Is that right?
Correct.
Well, the good news is that they're covered.
Yeah.
That's That's what I think is the bottom line. But, sir, did you wish to Senator Dames before?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just maybe a comment on Senator Champion's question. In Minnesota, you're required to carry proof of insurance. So if somebody wants to know, all they have to do is ask the Uber driver to see his proof of insurance. He would have that with him. So I think that would simplify it pretty easy without going to another step. If you have insurance and you ask for it, if I get in that vehicle, want to know what the insurance limits are, I can just ask for proof of insurance and I'll see that. So I think that takes care of it.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, that is also required under the ordinance.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of the reason we're moving forward with requiring Uber and others that have that model to have the coverage is so that we never wonder if somebody didn't have coverage. They dropped their insurance. They never carried it. They didn't carry enough. This way we know that they're going to have it because the main company is the one that's primarily responsible. But what I'd like to do, if I can now, is offer the A2 amendment. And the reason why I want to not offer it now, Mr. Chair, is so that I can get a feel for the people that are for the bill, and then those that are against it can tell us later if they don't like it either. But
I'd like to do this in the next 10, 12 minutes if we can. There's 3-4 other bills on that.
Yep.
We don't want to rush anything around here, but that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and I can save some time here just talking about this quickly. Senator Dietzick, I know there's been some conversation about this, but instead of $1.5 million, we lower it down to $1 million, and that's basically what it does. Every area that it's $1.5, it goes down to $1 million, so it's not as much, but it's still an adequate amount. And so that's the amendment that I'm offering.
So they'd be the million in all three of the places. Yeah. Is that correct?
It's always a million.
Senator Dietzick, did you have a comment on that?
I will take
that. I know people have been working on this for quite a while here. And
yep. Senator Metzen, thank you, Senator Gazelka. I would take that as a friendly amendment.
On the amendment, is further discussion on that? I think we can move on that. Senator Letts.
Thank you. Just one question. Do we know what coverage limits there are or mandates with regard to taxi companies? So we can compare it to the dollar amounts that are proposed here?
Mr. Chair. Welcome to the Minnesota Senate, Cap. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Cap O'Rourke, and I represent the major taxi companies in the Twin Cities. So to address Senator Latz's question and Senator Champion's question, there are currently two sets of insurance limits within the Twin Cities. You have the Minneapolis limit, which is, as Senator Dietzick said, 100, 300, 100, which is basically a $300 or $300,000 coverage. The MAC has a $600,000 coverage. However, what you also have is you have these larger taxi companies. Some of these large taxi companies own all of their vehicles or the majority of their vehicles. Some of these large taxi companies have the majority of their vehicles are owner-operated. In the best of our knowledge of throughout the Twin Cities, if there is a company with more than 10 vehicles that they own and operate, they already have a coverage of over the 1.5. I have three documents of three of the larger companies. These account for over 500 vehicles in the Twin Cities, and they have an aggregate coverage of $2 million. So the required limits are $300,000 and $600,000, but all of the major companies within the Twin Cities go above and beyond that. They are above the 1.5, and that was in Senator Dietzick's bill, and now $1 million. So there's kind of a differentiation between the owner-operators and the large companies. And I would simply say that as a one additional note is that with the definition of TNC on lines 1.12 and 1.13, some of our companies do use a web-based app to get rides, and we would request the use of between after compensation on line 1.12 and before using on lines 1.13, and the insertion of either primary or exclusively, whatever the committee feels is best. But that would kind of clarify that just applies to the TNCs, and it would then exclude the taxi cabs that use a variety of different methods to hail a ride. I hope that answered your question.
So, Chairman, moves to the Senator Letts.
So then, what would justify the distinction between the coverages that taxi companies are required and the TNCs would be required to have?
The major distinction is that the coverage that the taxi cabs have is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, commercial. No matter what you do, a lot of these cars, especially in the owner-operated cars, are used as both a personal vehicle and a commercial vehicle. So if I'm off the clock and I drop off my last passenger as a cab driver and I own my vehicle and I go to the grocery store and I get an accident, that accident is covered under my commercial insurance. So I have no option. I cannot opt in. I cannot go between my personal and my commercial. That car, that taxi, is 24 hours a day, always under the commercial insurance. And currently, under this proposal with the TNCs, they only have to provide the commercial insurance during business hours. So they can use their private insurance or their personal insurance when they're doing personal errands and whatnot. The cab drivers have to have commercial insurance on their cars at all times.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Let's.
So that would account for the differential in the coverage minimums? In your judgment, Mr. Rourke?
I don't know if he asked.
Yeah, this was a bill that was drafted by someone else. But that, I mean, we felt that as company. I mean, when we looked at what the big companies within the Twin Cities were doing, this fit in line with what our current levels of coverage are that we had chosen to do. There's been a longstanding belief that the Minneapolis coverage was low. And that is why all the major companies in Minneapolis have ticked a higher level of
telephone.
Coverage.
That's Minneapolis calling.
You need a ride.
They would be checking the app, Mr. Chair.
No, that's right.
So, Senator Lance, it may look like it's a big differentiation as far as what's required, but as far as what's being practically applied, it's pretty much in line with what the other major companies are doing.
Thank you.
Okay. Sir, did you wish to testify briefly?
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Robert Passmore, and I'm Assistant Vice President of Personal Lines Policy at the Property Casualty Insurance Association of America, which is better known and easier said as PCI. On behalf of our nearly 1,000 member companies, who together write 43% of the personal automobile or the automobile insurance written in Minnesota, over $1.4 billion in premium, I thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of Senate File 1679. Over the last couple of years, PCI and myself in particular have been following the emergence of a sharing economy where web and smartphone-based tools allow individuals to provide services and share goods and property. As some of these tools have morphed into commercial enterprises, some questions have been raised around the country regarding insurance coverage, most often about transportation network companies or TNCs that we've been talking about. Such as Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar, where people use their personal cars to provide transportation in exchange for a fee. As Mr. Johnson said before, for decades, personal automobile policies have had exclusions referred to as a livery exclusion, or basically for whenever your vehicle is being held out for hire or made available for hire. So most likely there'd be no coverage on a driver's personal auto policy for damages or injuries to people arising out of an accident that occurred while they were making themselves available for rides via TNC. Coverage would also likely be excluded on a first-party basis, coverage like uninsured and underinsured motorist, comprehensive inclusion, of course, PIP, as we've talked about before, too. The reason for the exclusion is simple. The kind of activities that a for-hire vehicle undertakes is much different than what you or I would do as we go about our business during the course of the day. Somebody who's made themselves active in the app, they're usually not going to do that while, there could be some people that try to do that while they're running their errands or things like that. But the way the apps work is that whoever is closest is going to be the person that gets the assignment. So basically, when you're holding yourself out for available, you're trying to get in position for the ride, much like a taxi driver would go. And you behave in a similar fashion, go to where the people are, where the restaurants, where the public events are, and things like that. That's the reason why it's a significantly different risk, and that's why there's different different kinds of coverages that have traditionally been available. While PCI doesn't oppose transportation networks as a business model and strongly supports innovation in transportation and insurance industries, there are some insurance issues that need to be addressed to protect the interest of the TNCs, their drivers, passengers, and, of course, the public at large. Working with our industry partners around the country, we've developed some what we've called essential elements to deal with some of these issues around the country, all of which are accounted for in Senate File 1679. So I'd like to spend just a little time comparing.
I think we're all right, though. I think we've heard a pretty good explanation of the bill and so forth, unless there's more that we need. But I think there's two people that would like to appear before. We're not cutting. I think you're in pretty good shape with the bill so far, so I would.
Thank you,
Justice. I think we're on that on the amendment.
Yeah, A2 amendment.
The next witnesses, before we take the amendment, we'll hear from Mr. Carlson and whoever else you have up here. I'm holding off on the amendment. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on that in addition to the bill's issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of Uber Technologies, the company I've represented since August of 2013. With me is one of our regional general managers, Michael White, and he's going to talk to the bill, and one of our Uber drivers, Dustin Simcoe, and I think he'd like to provide some testimony briefly to the committee as well about how it actually works in operation. And then I'll follow up. I have a couple comments on the bill itself.
Okay. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael White, and I'm the general manager for Uber in the Midwest. Mr. Chairman, senators, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me and allowing me to speak to you a little bit today. Uber is a technology company that was established in San Francisco in 2010, has been growing very quickly ever since. What we've developed is a smartphone application that allows individuals to request a ride right from their phone anytime they'd like, and get a reliable and safe ride on demand. And we've also, so what that's done is it enabled people all around the country to get picked up on an average of about 5 minutes from wherever it is that they are.
I think we understand a little bit of the concept, but now we want to know about if you oppose the bill or you oppose the, we tried to lower the limit to 1.5 to 1, as Senator Gasalka mentioned, but I think the concept of how this works, I think we're aware of that. So,
understood.
If that's all right.
I can speak to that. Thank you.
Yeah,
so,
thank you.
We oppose this bill. We think that the insurance requirements included here are really unmatched anywhere in the country. We're currently operating in over nearly 200 different markets around the world, in 50 different countries. We have legislation that's been passed at the state and municipal level in over 25 different municipalities around the country. And the requirements that are listed here in this bill are would really challenge our ability to operate within the state because of how onerous the requirements are. And they outstep what is in legislation in any other location. So there's a few specific points about the bill that are most concerning to us. The first is that this bill does not distinguish a difference between the different periods of the application. So period one, period two, and period three. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how those are different and why there's a distinction in every single other piece of legislation that's ever been passed that regulates TNCs. The vast majority of the drivers who use the Uber platform are part-time drivers, and they use it to make money on a very flexible basis. Nationally, drivers are operating on the platform about 4 to 6 hours a week on average. So what you have are they're part-time individuals who are using this to make additional money in their spare time. And what they've done is they've gone through a series of vettings in order to get access to the system. And then they turn on the app when it is that they'd like to make themselves available for rides. But at the time that they turn on the app, they have absolutely not committed to provide transportation to anyone in any way. So when they turn on the app, they may be sitting at a coffee shop. They may be running errands with their with a to-do list. They may be driving home from work or driving from another activity. So during that time period, there hasn't been any commitment to provide transportation to somebody. They're not being paid for that time. So this is not, in our mind, commercial activity, and it hasn't been recognized that way at commercial levels by any other legislation. So what's unique about this bill and what we oppose is the fact that this bill doesn't distinguish between those different periods. We accept and we support that once that a driver accepts a ride and is driving to pick somebody up or is actually transporting a rider, that there should be a commercial level of coverage at that time, and we'd support $1 million or $1.5 million of support, which is in line with the state requirements. During that period, one time period when the driver actually isn't engaged in commercial activity, the $1.5 million of coverage is way leaps and bounds above what's required given the activity that's happening here.
Try to talk about that. I think we're going to, at least I'm going to vote for the $1 million decrease. Mm-hmm. Try to use that number, I think.
Sure.
I can't speak for the committee, but that's where I feel we're headed.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
I know you probably don't like that either. But.
We're fine with that, Mr. Chairman. Just so you know, that's what's in place in Minnesota right now. We have $1 million coverage in place in Minneapolis by ordinance and St. Paul, the only two places where we operate.
All right. Yeah, we're talking about the state of Minnesota now, not Minneapolis.
I got it.
Go ahead.
So the other items that are unique to this bill that aren't covered elsewhere is there's an uninsured and underinsured requirement here at a $1.5 million level. This is not matched anywhere else in Minnesota law. It's way above the requirements currently on the books in Minnesota. It's not required by limos or taxis within the state to provide that level of coverage. So this is an onerous requirement that's been added to really try and hamper our ability to operate in the state versus actually providing any equal level of coverage to other transportation providers in the state. So that certainly is, to us, overstepping any type of level of safety and is really just meant to hamstring transportation network companies within the state. The other aspect here is the exclusion or not addressing the idea of a surplus lines insurer. Surplus lines insurers are a type of insurance company that provides coverage in times when there's a new industry or something that has been handled before, and transportation network companies absolutely fall within that requirement. And every one of those different ordinances that I've talked about have been passed in other states and other municipalities. Surplus lines insurance providers have been authorized in that in those statutes to provide this coverage. In fact, without that ability to acquire an insurance policy from a surplus lines insurer, TMCs wouldn't be able to provide this coverage. It doesn't exist outside of that new type of insurance provider. So that's one other area that we feel is a serious concern here. And then the last one is the requirement that TMCs provide collision and comprehensive insurance. Collision and comprehensive insurance is not a required insurance in any statute around the country. There's no state that requires any entity to provide collision or comprehensive insurance. They are optional insurers universally. And so the requirement to have a TMC provide this coverage, and as we read the bill, it requires us to provide it regardless of the individual's own policy. Again, well outsteps kind of safety standards that you would expect to find that we would support in a bill like this. So to be clear, we're very supportive of regulation. We're very supportive of a regulatory structure across the state that would provide a common framework for us to operate. I think there's specific items here that cause us serious concerns and are the reasons why we would not support or object to the bill as written.
Before we move the amendment, I just want to say Minneapolis and St. Paul have it in periods or phase one or two and three, but they don't have it in phase one. So the example that we heard earlier of the California case where the six-year-old was killed, when that app was on, if we look at the limits of Minneapolis, that there's 50,000 available. And we're saying we think even there $1 million should be available. you know, you're not a, you're, I suppose you're a new company still, but at $18 billion, you're a big player, and I love what you're doing. It's just that we also want to make sure that the individual is taken care of, that there's no gaps of insurance. And to me, that would be a big gap in insurance that we could have addressed. You can pass on to the driver in a cost. Your model's still going to be great. I'm still going to love it. But we're responsible to make sure we fill in those gaps. And that's what the A1 amendment does, or A2 amendment, or the bill.
Senator, if I could respond. And I appreciate that you bring up the case of Sophia Liu in California. I think that's a really, really unfortunate case. Certainly a sad, unfortunate thing that happened. As we described earlier, the driver was logged onto the app, but was not actually on a trip, and unfortunately struck that family, Sophia Liu was killed in that. So our hearts go out to the family in that instance. You should know, though, that there was absolutely no gap in insurance during that time. The driver's own insurance policy covered that, just as it would if the driver wasn't operating on the app, and that insurance company paid out as you would expect they would. So there wasn't a gap then. There's no gap now in the insurance coverages. And so I want to clarify that at any time the driver is logged onto the app, there is insurance coverage that applies.
Okay. All right. We're going to act on the Kosoko motion. Everybody, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question to Mr. Carlson or Mr. White. How do you differentiate yourself from a limousine service? Under 65B.134, the state requires limos to carry $1.5 million in coverage.
Senator, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, there are a number of distinctions, including the size of vehicle, the number of passengers that can be transported, commercial driver's license, and other requirements for existing limousine services that don't apply to rideshare. And, Senator Gazelka, I absolutely understand the point about coverage in period one. But our limits right now for you and I, were that accident to have occurred, is 30,000, 60,000, and 10. And you and I can have a discussion, I think a legitimate discussion, about our limits being so low. If that happened with an 80,000-pound truck, the limits in Minnesota are 100,000, 300,000. So I think that it's a legitimate discussion to have about the level of coverage during period one. But as Dustin Simcoe can tell you as a driver, to simply say I can leave my app on full time and pick up $1 million of coverage is simply unfair when they are not engaged in activity. And that's the problem. Whether you're a pizza delivery person or someone driving someone around at their daycare, where it's a home daycare operator, there is commercial use of our personal vehicles all the time. And to simply say, because in this instance you have the opportunity to work, we're going to require this level of coverage, which we haven't seen anywhere in the country. I sent a sheet around of what some of the major coverages are around the country during that period one. And the $1 million, and I'll refer to that number, Senator.
Sure. I think so.
Is still substantially higher than what is in place anywhere. And because you can have, and companies are developing, like GEICO, like Farmers, like USAA, developing endorsements for drivers to cover themselves during this period, you're never going to get that coverage at $1 million. You might get it at 50 and 100, which other companies are writing right now, but you're never going to be able to do it at $1 million of coverage in period one when you're not working. No.
Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Senator Sarko.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, if 25 of the commerce departments around the country are already saying there's a gap in coverage, I think there is a gap in coverage. And when we talk about livery needing a commercial license, the fact is that they've even had more training. And so now we have drivers in their 20s driving around picking up clients, have very little training, and then we're going to have little liability as well. I think that's a mistake. I think that's why putting $1 million on period one as well is important. In addition, if it's a low risk possibility that there's going to be a claim happening, then your rates are going to be lower for that as well. It's a direct correlation to how much risk is involved there. But for those few cases where there is a potential claim, where there's not coverage, we ought to make sure there's coverage there.
It just seems to me that nowadays, if you cripple somebody or somebody's killed, I know $1 million is a lot of money, but that's just my thought that,
I move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Letts, before the amendment.
To that point, I mean, I agree with you completely that, you know, if you cripple someone or kill someone, $1 million doesn't really go all that far, especially if it's a cripple effect. But that goes to the other point, which is the entire structure for our personal insurance coverage, which is way too low in my judgment. But for me, what I'm trying to determine is what's the legitimacy of distinguishing between that and period one for these particular drivers here, when they're really engaging in no different conduct than you or me driving home from work today.
I don't know.
Yet would be required to have coverage. I mean, other than having the app on. But other than having the app, I've got my phone on, you know, when I'm driving in the car. You know, it doesn't mean anything. I'm not doing anything in connection with the phone unless I were to get a call that says you got to come pick me up or I'm looking for it. Then all of a sudden I've changed modes. But until I get to that point, I'm still having trouble determining why there should be $1 million coverage in that first period. Just in that first period. I fully agree with it in the other periods. But I'm still having trouble saying why in the first period. Unless we want to increase all of our insurance.
We could look at that at another day.
Which we ought to. But there's really, there's a lack of comparability here. A much more substantial burden that this bill and this amendment, for at least the first part of the amendment, would impose for Uber and Lyft drivers who aren't actually carrying a fare or responding to a request for a fare.
Senator Jensen, did you have a response?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
I just want to say that for insurance to work, it has to actuarially be determined their exposure to risk. And that's what all insurance is. And if you decide that you're going to open for business, whether it's part-time, you're driving on the road, that exposure to that risk is what you're covering. So if you put on your app, we don't know if you're doing regular stuff, or the insurance company doesn't know if you're doing regular stuff, or if you're going around the airport, which has more traffic, or you're going around a mall because you want to get more things. Does that increase the level of exposure and the level of risk? We want to make sure that if they're providing more risk because of how they're driving, that the insurance is appropriately provided and that the coverages are appropriate to the amount of risk. If we say, well, they might not be, that I don't think is good enough. It should be that they have said, by clicking that on, I'm open for business. Just like when you turn the open sign on your business in a storefront, somebody might not come in all day, but you might have 1,000 people. It's the same idea on this commercial exposure to risk that an insurance company has to take into account when they actuarially charge you a premium for your rate. So I hope that we continue to consider that when you turn it on, you are open for business, and that is a commercial risk. Just like when you put a sign on your truck that says you are advertising as a business. I do. When we bought our truck, we had to decide, do I put my name on the side? If you do, then it's a commercial exposure. You need commercial insurance. So I hope we stay with this so that everybody's protected when people are out open for business on a commercial exposure.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts' response.
In response to that, I understand if there's an increased risk, but if Minnesotans right now have a minimum coverage of $30,000, and this would be a minimum coverage of $1 million because they turned the app on, if my math is right, that's a 3,000, percent difference in the coverage. Is it really 3,000 times the amount of risk because you've chosen to drive around the airport or the Mall of America?
Maybe we have to look at the other limits in another day, but Senator Housley, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to hear from the Uber driver, just because I know in period one, and you can explain it to me, but it is you're open for business, but it's also you're looking for business, and you don't have to accept the business. It's not until they lock in on the app. So he could be sitting in a coffee shop and deciding. I know when I use Uber, not everybody always wants to pick me up because I want to go like 20 miles, and maybe the Uber driver only wants to go 2 miles, so he doesn't have to engage in the business. So I'm just, I would like to hear from him if I could, just to hear how operates in phase
one. That's a fair question. How are you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Driver. Chair, Senators. I came to Uber New Year's Eve is when I started working for Uber. It opened up a lot of doors, flexibility, and freedom with my family. I personally, this is my sole income now, and I've gotten out of the corporate world that I used to do before to drive just for Uber. I feel that we're getting people home safely as well, and as you addressed, Senator Housley, that we do have the opportunity to either accept or deny a ride. And at that point, I'm accepting either having the risk or not having the risk. But there is no difference for me. If I'm on period one, I'm not any more risk than if I was driving myself home from work that day or driving my kids to daycare that day. So that's kind of like you said, Senator Housley, we have that option to accept or not to the ride that we have. So it's not something that we're required to do. A lot of Uber riders have mentioned the safety that they have with us, that it gets them home safely. They rely on us to get them home safe over the traditional taxi cab companies because they know that they're getting a good driver, they're getting a safe car. And we go through a pretty big background check on our DMV to make sure that we are safe drivers and that we're not higher risk.
I didn't get your name for the record.
It's Dustin Simcoe, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Further discussion on the amendment?
So,
Senator Latz.
I'd want to know what the recommendation is then from Uber as to what they think the appropriate coverage level should be in period one.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Sure.
You don't want any. Or go ahead.
It's not true.
Not true.
So we're supportive of the legislation that's passed in the city at the city level, and at both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, which if I remember correctly is 5130. Again, that's higher than the state minimum coverages, and is above the what would be classified of just acting as an individual. I also think it's worth clarifying exactly what happens when you turn on the app. There's no ongoing distraction from the app. It's not that you have to look at the app and you're constantly monitoring riders or you're seeing other cars flying around and you have to constantly be staring at a phone on your dashboard. Really all that happens is the app is engaged. It's less distracting than a GPS device would be or changing your radio station. When you get a request, if you choose to accept it, you simply just touch anywhere on the screen to accept that request.
Senator Jensen, you get the last word on this one.
Okay, so my question is, and my point is, when you click on the app, that can be determined, correct? We know when the app goes on. How would we ever know as an insurance adjuster or a company when you decide to pick up a passenger? This protects everybody and eliminates the gaps that happen because nobody can determine when that happens, when you turn it on, or when you actually accept a ride, or you're going to accept a ride. So this clarifies it for everybody. You are covered. If you're open for business, you're covered, and there isn't that gap.
So, Senator, I can answer that question.
Yeah,
and there's actually a moral hazard here. If you don't have the app on and then you were to get in an accident, let's say you weren't engaged in the app, and then you ran into somebody, you rear-ended somebody or somebody ran into you. Now with a $1.5 million or $1 million coverage, a driver could then just simply turn on the app, and it doesn't take any interaction with a rider or somebody requesting the ride from you. It's something that the driver controls themselves. They're able to now flip on the app and get $1 million of coverage. The difference between accepting a trip and starting that commercial activity is it takes a rider actually requesting a trip from you that you then have to accept to enter into that period two and period three range. So there actually is a question about the moral hazard of allowing somebody at the touch of a button to add $1 million in coverage to their
All right, that's the amendment.
So you can't accept?
Senator Latz.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, that's right.
So there would be an electronic record of accepting the ride?
Absolutely.
So, because Senator Jensen suggested, how would you know when you move from period one to period two?
When you're driving there and how far it takes you to get there.
Okay.
You accept the ride.
All right. So, at what point in the process do you accept the ride?
Oh,
or the request.
All right, we're going to kind of move along here. Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're having a lot of good discussion here, but I think let's let a little reality set in, and let's talk about maybe the difference in premium between 100, 50, 100, 300, or 30 versus a million. I don't think it's near as much as what people think it is, and I think we need to make sure that people are protected adequately. And if you are turning an app on, you are actually conducting business, and that's when it should start. So,
I think that was a – I'm not in that business, but I don't think it's dramatic or real steep, the coverage. But I'm not an insurance agent. And wait, before that, on Kasoka's motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
No.
Okay. Any final words or – Mr. Carlson, I think we reserved a couple.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the intention is if you're going to.
I guess transportation, I believe, is asked for it. Is that right, Senator Desick? So it does have one more stop.
The Mr. Chairman, then if the intention is to move the bill out of here today, then I do have some additional points that I think we need to discuss. One is relative to uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage in the bill, which is now at $1 million. The requirements for uninsured and underinsured coverage in Minnesota are $25,000 and $50,000. This bill requires now a TNC to carry $1 million coverage for uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, which is far in excess of what anyone is required to cover. And that limit, of which Senator Gazelka knows I've chafed about, has not been changed since 1974. And it does need to be increased. But to say we're going to operate in a vacuum and do it on this business model and not for everyone else, I think is punitive. Yeah. And
we've done that before around this building where, you know, if you want to change it, I agree with you, but the limits are artificially, I think, too low. But that's another day. Here we are today. And again, I'm going to say, in my opinion, $1 million isn't the end of the world anymore, but Senator Kasoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, the uninsured motorist, so you're the driver, somebody broadsides you. It's not their fault. They got hit. That driver is hurt. So he's hurt, and he's doing it during his business for Uber. He now has, if that person didn't have any insurance, which we said is about 15% of the people out there, then he has the right to collect off of that uninsured motorist for his own liability. I mean, for his own injury. It'd be just like he'd sue somebody else, but now they have no money, they didn't carry an insurance, so he's got the protection. So, and that's about roughly a tenth of the cost of what liability is. It's a, you know, overall an insignificant premium compared to liability. But so I don't, you know, I think it'd be a good business model for Uber to say we want to take care of our drivers, but you know, that's why I think we should do it.
And they're also covered. Mr. Chair, members, they're also covered by the $1 million commercial liability policy as well. So now we're adding on to that an additional $1 million of coverage. So you're at $2 million of coverage. And it isn't, believe me, that we don't want to provide coverage. And I think there is actually I don't think we're quite understanding the gap. Mm-hmm. What people talk about the gap around the country is that there is no insurance at all. There is no gap in coverage in Minnesota in the areas where these companies, Uber, Sidecar, Lyft, are operating, because the ordinance in Minneapolis requires from the moment the app is on that the TNC coverage is primary. First dollar, there is no gap. When you touch it and you've accepted a ride, you move from the 5,100 to $1 million. And that is what we operate on in Minnesota right now. Plus we provide PIP, plus we provide uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage.
Okay, well, you know, we're not Minneapolis or St. Paul. We're the state of Minnesota. We have our election certificates, and a lot of us feel, at least I'll tell you my feelings, that it should be the $1 million. So that's one vote, but St. Paul, Minneapolis, do what they want, but we're the state right here. Senator Desick, the final word here.
Thank you, members. I think this is a good discussion, and I ask for your support of the bill.
Senator
Pappas, would you? Senator Jensen.
Moves at the Senate. Senate file 1679 be passed as amended and referred to the Transportation Committee.
Okay. On that motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Are we going to respond to Mr. O'Rourke's suggestion about amending lines 12 and 13, line 12, with regard to primarily or exclusively? He made the request or suggestion, but we haven't had any discussion or input beyond that. I'd like to know whether that's a significant
refresh.
Mr. Chair, that is. So
primary or exclusively? Is
yes.
That
yeah, primarily it. Or exclusively.
What do you think of that?
I think it would help clarify that the cab drivers are not covered by this ordinance, or this primarily is what Mr. O'Rourke suggests.
Mr. Chairman, that would be on line...
The end of line 1.
Page
1,
line 12, after compensation, insert
yes.
Primarily.
Correct.
Senator Latz,
so
is that what you're
yes.
thinking? Okay, Senator Latz moves the amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion. Senator Latz.
Yes, there was also the question raised about surplus lines that were allowed, and we haven't really had any response or discussion about that suggestion that came from the TNCs. It appears, at least from the list that was handed out, that this legislation would be the only jurisdiction that would not allow coverage to be provided by surplus lines. So I don't know enough about the topic to make an informed decision there. I'd like to hear from some of those.
Senator Desick, did you want to respond to Senator Latz?
My understanding is the bill does not prohibit it from using surplus lines. They just have to say under Chapter 60A, they just need to say why they are using the surplus lines. And so it allows insurance, it allows companies, if there is not a product out there, it allows them to use a surplus line.
Mr. Carlson, did you?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, surplus lines are also called excess and specialty insurance carriers. And this clearly is a specialty market. What the language in the bill says to us is that if a property casualty insurer who doesn't want to develop the market right now but says they can, they take the business away, surplus and excess carrier, and say now you have to give it to State Farm. That's unfair. The surplus line carrier that developed this model has been used around the country, and I think it's unfair to say that through a decision of the commissioner, they're simply going to say now the existing property and casualty companies that are writing automobile insurance get the business that you've developed. We think that's unfair.
No. So, Mr. Left. Chairman, I mean, I'll readily acknowledge my ignorance of how all these different insurance yeah. providers and lines fit together, but is there some reason why the legislation proposes to prefer or to give preference for one group of insurers as opposed to other groups of insurers?
Senator Jensen, did you take a shot at that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're on deck.
I can just say from the storage bill that we heard in this committee, we altered our how we were doing it so that you couldn't use the surplus lines because they're not regulated by the Department of Commerce, and they are not under the guarantee that a standard company has. So there were some things in that particular bill that we addressed by doing that same type of thing. So I think someone else can talk to it, too. But there are some differences that we need to be aware of.
Mr. Johnson, then we're going to – I think we're ready to vote.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation, just very briefly, with the placement in this bill of this language in Chapter 65B, it automatically puts this coverage under Senator Dietzick referenced this Chapter 60A. It's part of the long-standing Minnesota law governing excess surplus lines. Senator Latz, there's no special treatment under that statute. There's some statutory presumptions that if you meet the presumptions, then the coverages can go to the excess surplus lines. There's no special treatment given here. This coverage is put exactly in the statute that the other coverages, and so by its placement in 65B, that statute is operational. It doesn't grant any favors. You can get to the excess surplus lines. You just have to meet the presumptions that have been in the statute. So we think that's the right placement of it. It's not clear on the face of the bill, but by doing it that way, that is how it operates, and I think that's the fair way. That's how all lines today, how they get to the excess surplus carriers, this is treated exactly as auto, homeowners, work comp, all the other lines of insurance that the legislature has chosen to put in that statute. This puts it in there. We think that's the fair treatment of it. It doesn't preclude it, but if you meet the standards, the presumptions, then you get to go to that, to the excess surplus carriers.
Senator Jensen renews her motion that the Senate file 1679 as amended be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Transportation Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much. I'm told that we have till 2 o'clock, so those members that could stay here, I'd appreciate it so we don't have to come back tonight. But Senator Laurie, you've been waiting. So Senator Rest, I see, is on deck.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate file 1523.
Senator Laurie.
This is a Department of Commerce health policy bill. I'll step you through it real quickly. It's pretty simple, straightforward. There are six sections. Section one provides the agency the tools to, when reviewing drug formularies, to identify whether a plan is complying with existing law requiring orally administered anti-cancer medication to be priced the same as IV or injected anti-cancer medication. Sections 2 and 4 restore the rating requirements for grandfathered plans that were inadvertently deleted as part of the market rules bill 2 years ago. And just by way of reference, the department issued a temporary stay of enforcement that expires on May 1st, so this would bring that in line. Sections 3 and 5 are technical correction changes related to dependent children and portability of coverage. And Section 6 extends the amount of time a consumer has to request an external review of an adverse determination by an insurer from 6 months to 12 months. And that's the extent of the bill. I do have an A1 author's amendment as well to clarify a couple of pieces. If somebody could move the A1 author's amendment, I would appreciate it.
I think Senator Pappas is ready to do this.
Happy to do it.
On the Pappas motion, all those in favor, should everybody say aye.
Aye.
You got the department with you, I see, Senator Laurie. And
yeah, Mr. Chair, if there's questions, otherwise.
What's the, that's 6 to 12 months, is that?
The 6 to 12 months.
Is that all right?
Well, you know, I'm not certain that everybody thinks it's all right. I'm not sure.
Well, if you think it's all right,
ask,
Senator.
I think it's all right.
Let me ask this, Senator Kosoka.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about that Section 6 to Mr. Brickwoody. Did you discuss with the plans ahead of time? This is supposed to be a commerce technical bill. I want to know what kind of conversations happened before this was introduced or given out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kosoka, again, Peter Brickwoody from the Commerce Department. We are having ongoing conversations with health insurers. We discussed it with one of the plans prior to introduction of the bill and been getting feedback, and I think we're having a good dialogue. We may, as the process moves forward, find somewhere between 6 and 12 months but have committed to working on that. But from our view, the experience of the Commerce Department over the last 2 years is what has driven this proposal. We have received a number of inquiries from constituents who have, for a variety of reasons, not been able to proceed with an external review because they have come to the department looking for assistance after that six-month mark. And so we see this as a pro-consumer move that should adequately allow the proper time for people to be able to gather the documents and proceed with an external review if that's something they would like to see.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Laurie, did you?
Just on that point, Senator Kosoka, this is a Department of Policy bill. I hope I didn't characterize it as merely technical, because that's not just technical. That is actually a consumer protection policy that is being
proposed and supported by the department, but it's not a technical change, and I didn't mean to characterize it as that. This is a policy bill, not necessarily all technical. The rest of them are fairly technical, but this one is a policy more than technical.
Second. Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, members, you know, it's been a policy here that we want the Commerce Department to make sure they're having a conversation with the folks ahead of time. I'm not sure how far ahead of time it came. I was going to recommend we delete Section 6 because of that, but instead I'd like to have an author's amendment that we change that 12 months to 9 months, just so that there's more conversation. If it goes to 12, when you guys work through it, fine. I know the feds require 4 months. We have 6. You know, without really any conversation ahead of time, I don't think, you know, doubling it is appropriate. But, you know, I don't mind that people have a little bit of time, but I'd like to move that to 9 months instead of 12 months. That's line 5.34, where it says 12 months, it would go to 9 months. Senator Lori, I just would like
Lori,
your
opinion. Any discussion on that? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I'm, you know, I'm comfortable with the 12. I'm not going to, you know, fight you on the 9. I'll go with the committee's wishes on that. I personally think that 12 is reasonable, and the department does have several examples of individuals who wished to pursue beyond the 6 months, and I think that it's a good consumer protection, but I will go with the committee's decision.
Any
on
further
this.
Discussion on the amendment? Moving it from 6 to 12 to 9. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to stick with the author on this at 12, so I'll be voting against the amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I think if we adopt this, we'll have unanimous support.
Well, you're probably not going to get it.
No. I'm on the final bill.
On the consent motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, one other item that I'm not going to blow up the committee's time with, but I did have another conversation with the health plans over the weekend and over the last few days. One issue dealing with the manner in which deductibles are set and embedded deductibles is a very complicated issue that some consumers were surprised in the manner in which a couple, like one of the spouses, could run into a situation where the deductible was the entire family deductible and it ran way past the individual deductible that people thought they were purchasing. I understand there's federal guidance that kind of addresses what I was trying to accomplish, and I'm comfortable with that at this point. I'm trying to get some clarity on exactly what it means, so I'm not going to offer that amendment. But there is also significant room for a great deal of clarity and consistency around the language and the terminology used so that consumers actually understand how their deductible will affect them in the instance of an illness that yields a significant bill. And so Commerce is going to work with industry to provide that consistency and that clarity and transparency for the end consumer to make sure they understand how the product they purchase will be used.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lurie. Are you speaking of deductible, or are you talking deductible and co-insurance?
Senator Dames, I'm talking about deductibles specifically.
Strictly deductibles. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, if you do move forward with that language, I'd want to know about it if we're not dealing with it in the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I don't intend to introduce it later, provided that the information I've been given is correct, and I assume that it is. It's a 500-and-some-page guidance from the feds that came out 2 weeks ago. I haven't completely absorbed it, but I do take people at their word.
We have the author's assurance there.
Mr. Chair, I can hand that out for members if they wish.
I'll move the bill. Set a file 1523. Okay. We recommend a pass.
Did we... amended. We didn't add the amendment. We amended it. You amended it. Yeah, as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, look for reals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair and members.
You very patient. Thank you. This has been kind of a long meeting here today, but very good discussion on these topics so far, which is good. Senator Rest, welcome to the committee. Senate File 1099, Children's Products, Chemicals of High Concern, Presence, Reporting, and Regulations. Senator Rest, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good afternoon. I bring you Senate File 1099, which is an updating of the Toxic-Free Kids Act that was first passed in 2009. And what the bill before you today does is to set up a reporting system for products that contain one of the nine priority chemicals that have been developed by the Department of Health. Priority chemical is a term of art. It does mean a chemical that's been identified as toxic. And the Toxic-Free Kids Act is aimed at products that are presented for the use of children under 12. The bill provides for a reporting system. It does not ban any chemicals. It simply asks manufacturers of those chemicals to report products that they sell for the use of children under 12 to report that they have that chemical in one of the nine chemicals, and I think you have some information on that. A chemical such as cadmium or lead as an example. The bill does provide for a process by which a product can be delisted from the from making the reporting if the product is gets rid of the chemical that caused it to be reported in the first place. There has been a lot of discussion about the what kind of a burden this causes on manufacturers. It is not without cost, obviously. The first 2 years of it to set up the reporting system, which is simply a website that is to be developed where parents and other adults who are concerned about the chemicals in the products that they buy for their children, where they can go and see if that product indeed had a one of the nine priority chemicals in it. The bill does not ban the use of these chemicals, but it does require that they be reported. If the manufacturer chooses not to do the reporting, then there is a mechanism where an independent contractor can analyze the product and determine whether there is a one of the high priority chemicals is in the product. There is a phase in for the reporting system and a fee system, and there is a fee system that comes into play after the first 2 years of setting up the website. Phase in over 6 years so that if a product does have the chemical in it, there is a $1,000 fee that goes two places. One, it helps pay for the administration of the program itself, setting up the website and the reporting process. And then secondly, it can be used in funds that would support research for safer chemicals. Again, it's an updating of the 2009 bill. I have had a lot of discussion in the last few days with various leaders, including the majority leader, and I've come to the conclusion that one part of this bill, which was, a dramatic, overly dramatic, perhaps, reach, is something that is a distraction in the bill and should be removed. and I have spoken with Senator Reinert, and
Mr.
he
Chair,
indicated
really
that
we got a lot of.
I don't know what's going
hear.
On out in the hallway.
I'm
but
really trying to speak very loud.
Hey, that's better.
You're doing a good job. It's not
okay,
your fault.
You ready?
Yeah, that's better.
It's these rowdy people out in the hallway there.
Senator Reinert has graciously agreed to offer the amendment, and what it does is reinstate the language of the exemption for food and food products. So I hope that the members will respond favorably to my request to remove. Yep. It's not removing it. It's reinstating the stricken language in the statute, which created the exemption from this system. So it's on page
5, 10.
I think
since Senator Reinert has the site.
Yeah, I know there's been kind of compromised language the last 3-4 days that I'm aware of, and
it's on page 5, lines 9 and 10.
And Senator Reinert.
Mr. Chair, I'd make that motion to reinstate the language.
He understands it.
Lines 9 and 10 on page 5.
Senator Latz.
Chairman, you suggested this was compromised language.
That's what I get out of it.
Can I get some clarity on that, please?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, as the author, I support removing it. I think that it really does go a step beyond while we're really trying to get the reporting mechanism and the website up, and I would like to revisit that exemption in another year.
It's only on the website, is that correct? I think you mentioned that a couple times.
Really thinking that the most important thing here is to get the website up and running and the reporting system in place for those products for children, intended for use by children, but at this point not including the food and food or beverage packaging, except for the baby food. We've dealt with baby food before.
On the Reinert Amendment, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevailed. Now, do we have to hear from, if you have some witnesses or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. If the if the committee acts favorably on it, it needs to go to finance. It's part of the governor's budget initiative, and I believe it would go to Senator Tomasoni's division. The governor has proposed $543,000 in the first year and some $400,000 in the second year to initiate the beginning expenses for this website.
Senator Kazoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, Section 8, the fees, how often are they collected? And then exactly, where are those fees going? What is the breakdown of where those fees are going?
The fees, and if there's someone here from the PCA who can help us with the details of that, but beginning in the third year, the manufacturer reporting that one of these chemicals is in a product intended for children under 12 to be used by them, there is a $1,000 fee. And then over the next year, that product still contains that toxic chemical, like formaldehyde. Well, I guess that's covered in other places because I did that bill before. But like cadmium, like lead, that there is then $1,000 plus another $1,000. And those funds, again, can be used for the administration of the program, so it pays for itself, and or to set up research funds to help manufacturers get rid of the toxic chemicals that they are manufacturing for to be used by children under 12. And if we could let the PCA maybe put some more flesh on that comment, then that might, even if you don't like the program, Senator Gazelka, at least you'd understand how
it works. Yeah, and if I can follow up, Mr. Chair, because it's basically $1,000 per product, per company, per year that they're using them, whether or not they're scientifically proved to be harmful or not. We're concerned about them, but we yet don't know some of them, but we're going to be collecting $1,000 per product, per company, per year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, these nine chemicals have been identified through evidence-based science as being toxic in products for children in children under 12. And for example, and they do have a different impact, by the way, and that is clear, I think, in the discussion of these proposals in the past. They do have a different impact on adults, and the chemicals have to be intentionally inserted into the product. We all know that formaldehyde occurs in an ambient way in nature. We're all exposed to it, and we all know that adults can deal with it because of, you know, their development is finished and their body weight and so forth. They can deal with it much more easily than a child of two in terms of its impact on their growth and so forth. So these are not guesses as to these chemicals. They have been already identified by the Department of Health. If a manufacturer can show that that product no longer contains that chemical, then it's delisted. It does not need to continue doing any of that reporting. And I'll let him correct any information that was not specific enough.
Sir, did you wish to give us a 1.5-minute description of what you feel is important here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelko with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The author did a good job of explaining the dollars and how they would be used. I can go into more detail if the committee would like. Otherwise, we could just move on with the other supporting testimony.
Yeah, we've got Mr. Quillis and Sarah Rosina, American Chemical Council. Would you like to come up front? And we do have to be out of here by 2 o'clock, so just everybody keep that in mind.
And Mr. Chairman, I would ask both the supporters and the opponents to be respectful of your time and to be
Thank
brief.
You very much. So, ma'am, welcome to the Committee of Commerce.
Yes.
No, just talk. Good afternoon, Chairman Metzen and members of the Senate Commerce Committee.
Before that, excuse me, yes. Senator Franzen and Hoffman, I hate to do this to you. You've been sitting here patiently, but I think your bill's going to take some discussion, and I'm going to set you free this afternoon. And I know you're sitting there for quite a while, but we got more discussion on this bill, and we wouldn't give you justify enough time for you. So that's what we're going to do. Excuse me. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Metzen and members of the Senate Commerce Committee, the American Chemistry Council is pleased. My name is Sarah Brezina. I'm a senior director at the American Chemistry Council in Washington, D.C. We're pleased to offer comments on Minnesota's Senate File 1099. ACC represents the leading companies engaged in the business of chemistry. Our members include companies that are located in and do business in Minnesota. We apply the science of chemistry to make the chemicals used by a wide variety of industries and businesses to make innovative products, technologies, and services. Safety is a top priority for ACC and its member companies. My expertise is in chemical regulation at the federal level, and I thought it would be useful for you all in looking at this bill to understand whether what EPA is doing today would suggest that this legislation may not be needed, and whether it may not produce the results that you all are hoping for. EPA has been enhancing its chemical regulation through several programs over the last 5 years. reporting requirements under the chemical data reporting rule, under which chemical manufacturers have been reporting to EPA the uses of their chemicals in industrial uses, commercial uses, consumer uses, and including children's products uses. So chemical manufacturers have been providing information on upwards of 8,000 chemicals which they manufacture and telling EPA how they're used. There's also an EPA program called the Work Plan Chemicals Program. Under this program, EPA has targeted 90 chemicals for assessment, targeted assessment. The 9 priority Minnesota chemicals are already in the EPA Work Plan Program. EPA will be conducting assessment of these and managing their risks where needed, including, if needed, in their uses in children's products. How EPA has been doing these programs has been based on science. They identify the high priorities for the work plan chemicals based on the highest potential for hazard and the highest potential for exposure. In our view, this is in contrast to SF-1099, which really requires reporting based on merely detection or presence in children's products. Detection does not mean harm. Further, in assessing a chemical's risk under the work plan program, EPA first assesses the conditions of use and the chemicals used in them before deciding whether risk management is needed. Again, in contrast to EPA's approach, SF-1099 would promote the phase-out of priority chemicals from children's products, really, again, sort of based on are they there? It's a reporting program with a fee, with a goal to getting these compounds out simply because they can be detected. Analytical chemistry has been doing nothing but improving over the years. We can detect at smaller and smaller levels chemicals in anything, nano levels and below. This is not a science-based way to essentially promote the phase-out of these chemicals, and it may not be needed anyway with EPA working on them. So in our view, this bill is not science-based. You may ask, well, so what? It's precautionary. But the so what is a lot of money is going to be spent to report, to test and report whether these chemicals are in these products without any assurance that children are going to be any safer. So you may be spending a lot of money. There's also some concerns I have with some of the provisions in Section 7, Subdivision 3 and 5. It looks like the treatment of the priority chemicals and the safer alternatives is different relative to trade secrets. I don't quite understand why one would be treated as a trade secret and one would be considered public data. Bottom line, do you need this bill and this law when EPA is on the case? Is detection any evidence of risk? We would say no. You need more of an assessment to make that determination. And will this simply have the unintended consequence of causing companies to reformulate into products that Minnesota is not going to be paying attention to what they're reformulating into? So there's a lot of questions about this bill that are purely science-based, and you really ought to move very carefully before considering passing of it. Thank you
very
much. Mr.
Quillis, did you have a half a minute here?
Mr. Chairman,
we're going to try to move on this legislation, I think.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll try and be brief, Mr. Chairman, but this is an issue that is of utmost importance to the Chamber of Commerce and some of our members. Mr. Chairman, have you heard Ms. Zima has talked about what's going on at the federal level, and we are fully supportive of that. Children's products are already heavily regulated at the federal level, either through the Food and Drug Administration, through the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, through the EPA, and on the state level from our Pollution Control Agency through the Department of Health as well as the Department of Commerce. 4 concerns, Mr. Chairman, with the bill that we have right now. There's an extensive amount of data available right now that exists dealing with chemical regulation. There's no sense in going through and reinventing the wheel. The states of Washington, Maine, Vermont, California, Oregon all have information out there right now and have reciprocal sharing agreements where they can trade it among each other. Mr. Chairman, I want to bring your attention to something called the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse. It's a efficient, it goes through and it has a bunch of states in it, and it wants them to be efficient and effective for state, local, tribal initiatives, and they should be collaborating and coordinating. It allows them to promote safer chemicals and products,
and it allows them to assure access to high-quality chemical data and assessment methods. That website, Mr. Chairman, allows you to search for chemical regulations through state, through chemicals, through product types. And it's out there already right now, Mr. Chairman. Members, states that are members of that Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse are California, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Massachusetts, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and the state of Minnesota through the Pollution Control Agency and through the Department of Health. Mr. Chairman, I went just last night onto the state of Washington Department of Ecology. And some of the data, it's not all of the data that the advocates are looking for, but some of the data that I just did three of the nine chemicals last night regarding bisphenol A, cadmium, and formaldehyde. And I got the reports right here, Mr. Chairman, with the chemicals, with their chemical abstract numbers, the amounts that they're in the products, and the product category that they're in. That was available last night just by me going through and looking at the state of Washington. So we think it's duplicative, Mr. Chairman, to go through and create, reinvent the wheel here in the state of Minnesota.
We have a...
Mr. Chairman?
Make a motion. Senator Rest?
I didn't expect to only have coming forward people who are opposed to the bill. There are people here who are supportive of it. I wonder if we could at least have one person speak who supports the bill.
All right, I agree with that.
And then I have some responses to the
opposition. But we're not going to do any more discussion today. We're going to lay this over and take a little shot at it. What do we get back? Wednesday?
Oh, we're not coming back tonight?
No, unless you want to. You'll probably be all alone, Senator.
No, we're not.
I think that's what we're going to do.
That's just fine. I understand and I appreciate.
I know, Dan, this opportunity. I'm afraid we're going to have to get you back. There's another committee coming in right now, and we actually stole a half an hour.
Mr. Chairman, if we could just then continue from this point, so that I could on the Wednesday hearing just get to supporters, so that we don't have to report the negative. Thank you.
But that good work, committee. I know it kind of lasted pretty long, but we did a good job, I think. With that, the committee is adjourned until Wednesday.
Going to save.